I assume your being here doesn't mean you didn't have the energy to take the mine hike, and that you were up to talking about sexuality at 10:45 in the morning. For the tape, this is Elmer Witt talking about life can be sexual, and that's what the session is going to be about. For those of you who haven't already caught on to what I think is sort of obvious, is that those of us who come up here on teaching staff are glad to be here because we always learn things from other people that we can use all year long and pretend that it's ours. Here's something I learned a couple of years ago, and maybe it's been done a couple of times during the summer, from George Anderson, when I heard him. He was here, you know, the last couple of weeks. Have you ever heard the story about how I know God isn't a Lutheran? It's the story of creation. If God were a Lutheran, the book of Genesis would read something like this. By the way, it has nothing to do with life and sexual. It's just something I like to do. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, so God created a small committee. God carefully balanced the committee vis-a-vis race, sex, ethnic origin, and economic status in order to interface pluralism, love those words, with a holistic concept of self-determinism according to judicatory guidelines. Even God was impressed, and so ended the first day. And God said, let the committee draw up a mission statement. And behold, the committee decided to prioritize and strategize. And God called the process empowerment. And God thought it sounded pretty good. And evening and morning were the second day. And God said, let the committee determine goals and objectives and engage in long-range planning. And unfortunately, a debate as to the semantic difference between goals and objectives preempted almost all of the third day. Although the question was never satisfactorily resolved, God thought the process was constructive, and evening and morning were the third day. And God said, let there be a retreat, I love it, in which the committee can envision functional organization and engage in planning by objective. This really gets at LCA, for those of you who don't know the difference between LC and LCA. The committee considered adjustment of priorities and consequent alternatives to program direction, and God saw that this was good, and God thought it was even worth all the coffee and donuts he had to supply. And so ended the fourth day. And God said, let the program be implemented consistent with long-range planning and strategy. The committee considered guidelines and linkages and structural sensitivities and alternatives and implementational models. And God saw that this was very democratic and so would have ended the fifth day, except the unintentional renewal of the debate about the difference between goals and objectives. On the sixth day, the committee agreed on criteria for adjudicatory assessment and evaluation. This wasn't the agenda God had planned. He wasn't able to attend the meeting, however, because he had to take the afternoon off to create day and night and heaven and earth and seas and plants and trees and seasons and years, the sun and moon, the birds and fish and animals and human beings. And on the seventh day, God rested. And the committee submitted its recommendation. And it turned out that the recommended form for things was nearly identical with the way God had already created them. So the committee passed a resolution commending God for his implementation according to guidelines. There was, however, some opinion expressed quietly that man should have been created in the committee's image. And God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the committee. I like that. I don't know if George created that, but that's from George Anderson. We're going to talk about sexuality. And let me start by asking, maybe a priori, where did you get your sex education? Would you be willing to share? Where did you get your sex education?
From my husband.
Okay. What else? From a cousin.
Fifth grade classroom.
Fifth grade classroom.
In a dark room with the lights all out and very... maybe we should talk about this because you're getting to be a teenager.
From?
My mother.
From your mother. Somebody else?
Church retreat.
Church retreat. As part of the program?
Yes.
I'm sorry. My wife warns me about doing that, and I still do it. I'm sorry. Interesting. Anybody else? Yes.
Dr. Theodore Hubenvik at Spicer Lutheran Bible Camp in Minnesota.
Wow.
He was a great professor at St. Olaf College who tells a story that he used the word circumcision in one of his Bible studies. And one of the freshman girls says, Dr. Hubenvik, what is circumcision? Took his hands, damn freshman girls.
And that was the beginning, huh? Interesting. Anyone else?
In fifth grade, we saw, they showed us a movie on menstruation, but it was for the girls only.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But sex education is different from just facts of how you make babies and how you have menstrual periods and things. I'm trying to think if there's more than, you know, there isn't one place that I got it, because mm-hmm. it's more than that.
Mm-hmm. Probably most of what we were talking about so far were with, what's her name? I forgot my name at home. Called organ recitals, which is that form of which is, you know, the biological or genetically oriented information about sex.
Right.
Most of the time, that's what people mean by that. And of course, that was the entree for what we're doing. I said this the other day, I think we're talking about marriage, but I want to say it again because it's explicitly pertinent here, that the word sex and sexuality are used in two different ways by lots of people today, not everyone. And I will be using that way again here. It's very difficult because the word sex and sexuality have the same adverbial and adjectival forms. If you say sexual, you can be talking about genital activity, or you can be talking about a broader concept of what it means to be a sexual being. So when I say life can be sexual and intend to talk about sexuality here, I want to be clear, or try to be clear, and it's not always easy to do, that what I'm referring to is that more complex, broader, inclusive idea of what it means to be, what it means to you, individually and to me, and what it means generally in the society to be a woman or a man. It includes, indeed, and in some senses depends on, genital and biological activity, but it is much more than that. It's the self-perception, it's the effort to use what we are, who we are, in relating to other people. It isn't the only way to think of oneself, but it does affect almost all of what we think of and think of ourselves. And so sexuality in that sense is what I would like to be talking about today. It's clear to me that if anyone, and this has been for now almost 20 years, maybe more, if anyone doesn't have information about reproductive process and menstruation and all the rest, that's because they have chosen not to, because it's all available. And it's available in good style. You can get very quality sex information as it relates to biological process and the reproductive process and the functioning, the inner functioning of the body. It seems a little more difficult to come by to get information that is well done about human sexuality. In fact, someone asked me earlier this morning, what are some good books I can pass along to others? And that was difficult to come up with. I went out and went to the authors and title index to be plowing around. We'll talk about that later. There are some helpful books I'll refer to, but most of them are thicker kinds of things and not something that's done yet perhaps as well and what I would call a popular level. I want to, having said that, or to say it another way, come back to the same thing another way, I would be attacking the genitalization of sex so that almost all the times we refer to it, all the humorous responses have to do with some overtone of the genital activity. Now, one, not the one, one claim I have to fame is I almost got on the Johnny Carson show years ago when I wrote a book called Life Can Be Sexual. It changed because Johnny went out of town and the co-host or whoever took his place, it didn't work out. But one of the things I was going to talk about was the importance and, I think, usefulness of double entendre or triple entendre, where we do jokes about things meaning two or three other things at the same time. I think it's a healthy kind of a business. And to be able to laugh at not only our sex activities, but our sexuality is an important part of the process, I think, of growing both mature about it and perhaps also knowledgeable. So I'm not saying that it's bad that a lot of our humor is based on the fact that we're talking about something that people do where we don't see them, the hidden part of it, or the parts of ourselves that we don't expose. It's that the humor involved is often related to its restricted, its off-limitness. The other kind of sexual humor, which deals with being human, man and woman or else, is not quite as guaranteed a response. You almost can guarantee a response if your humor is genitally oriented, assuming that it's halfway decent humor at the same time. But that genitalization of sex is what has, it seems to me, got us into so much of our difficulty for growing up as sexual beings. For one thing, because we don't think of it in a broad context, and for another is that it's hard for us to understand how sex activity, genital sex activity, fits into any kind of a picture. And so even the church's response has been to teach about sex in terms of sexual ethics. And already you're at the point of talking about, probably, behavior, right and wrong, and have most times come out of prescriptions or proscriptions about what kinds of things you can do or not do. I think that's important, but I think that belongs after an understanding of what it means to be, theologically, a sexual person. Carl Jung and James Nelson in his book Embodiment, and I'll be referring to that a couple of times, I think it's one of the best things that's happened. Let me put on tape what I say, I think once a year whenever I'm at Holden. When I say a book is good, I mean I found an idea in it. It might have been one idea on one page, and then I'll say the book is good. That is not an endorsement of everything that's in a book. This comes back to haunt one after a while. Even when I say I like scriptures, there are parts in it that I have a lot of trouble with in scriptures. That doesn't mean I reject it, but I'm not saying everything in there is exactly the way I understand it or like it. But generally in books, if I find an idea in a book or an insight, I think it's a pretty good book. Now that's perhaps because my expectations are terribly low of books, or many, you know, of maybe of my ability to understand a book. So when I say I think Embodiment is great, there's loads in that what I would argue about for a long time. I still say it's a good book, and I would encourage people to read it, and I'll talk about it again after a while. But Jim Nelson talks about Carl Jung saying that when people brought sexual questions to him, they invariably turned out to be religious questions. And that when they brought religious questions to him, they always turned out to be sexual questions. That's interesting. I'm a little bothered about the always and invariably in it, but it is interesting that sexual questions have an almost inevitable religious dimension. For instance, how creation and God's purpose in creating us as sexual beings affects the way we think about religious questions. Or human nature and human destiny. What is it that God had in mind, and how does that affect the difference between male and female? How does that affect the kinds of questions that you might ask? Or sin and salvation. What does it mean to be, as Nelson does in his book, alienated sexually, or have salvation sexual? Or indeed love, justice, and community? For some time before reading Nelson's book, I've been teaching a course at the university called Religion and Human Sexuality. It was my sneaky way to get at comparative religion by means of sexuality. We have guest speakers,
seven of them usually, sometimes eight, who come and tell about their religion in terms of its teaching about human sexuality. That's very difficult to do, to find people who are willing to do that. Because most of them will come in and say whether they're against abortion or not, and whether you should have premarital or extramarital sex. And that's all part of it, as I said before. But to talk about what it means to be male and female, what it means to be created, what it means to have as a destiny to relate to other people, we invite these people to talk about that. And then analyze what they've done, where they come from, and all that business in the course. The course then becomes really a growth in understanding human sexuality, but also in how, where people come from. Where did they get their ideas? Was it biblical? Was it sociological? Was it natural? Was it law? Whatever what it was. At the end of the course, they're expected to be able to discern how they were being taken, if you will. What was that person trying to sell? And where did it come from? I think it's a good course. I enjoy it. I think people learn in it. But that has to do with seeing all of life as having a possible having a sexual dimension to it. In a sense, it's as black theology grew up and had an emphasis because of our misunderstanding of who we are in relationship to people that are different colors from us, or the black person growing up and trying to relate what their blackness meant to their theology, or political theology or liberation theology, in a sense there is a need for sexual theology. I do not advocate that. I don't even go around talking about it. But it seems to me that it's important to grow in that area. Well, let me emphasize four or five things that I think are important as one does this. And then distribute some stuff that I think is an attempt to do it, and then we can talk about that. I think as we talk about this, it's terribly important to observe that in the midst of what could well be called sexual chaos and confusion today, changes, people experimenting, all kinds of things happening. One of the most popular discussions I think we have is, you know, hear people on streetcars or anywhere talking about, isn't it terrible how things have really gone to pot in terms of, we usually say, morality. What we mean is sexual, often sex activities. In the midst of that, I detect, and I don't know where you, how you would respond to it, a terrible longing for serious and meaningful human sexual relationships. Sexual, now again, in the sense of the broadest context, not necessarily only sex activity context, but serious, meaningful sexual, human sexual relationships. If that's true, then we've got a serious task ahead of us. And it isn't just an exploration of what can we learn. It is how do we respond to where loads of our people are. And it seems to me that we might, if we have something wise to say about that, since I work in a mission field, it's called the university, Governor State University, where people are mostly distant from God or scriptures. The people in my courses, most of them have never had a Bible in their hand before. Not read it, but had one in their hand. Those people are looking, many of them, for serious, meaningful human sexual relationships. Secondly, a need in looking at this is to deal, or wrestle with, I'd say, the important insights of feminism and feminist theology. Because I think the breakthroughs that have been coming from their perspective of understanding the biblical literature is terribly important and very difficult for those of us who were trained not only in patriarchal, but as I am wont to say, European patriarchy. It wasn't even a good American patriarchal system that most of us received, but a European one. I'm not saying European is bad, but I think it's even more distant than from the one that we have now. Therefore, I think feminist theology is terribly important. Thirdly, to grapple with the possibility that our sexual meanings really are socially condition much more than biologically, to grapple with it. I'm not saying whether it's true or not. I have suspicions about it, maybe inclinations about it, but that's an important aspect of it. We have assumed, one of the big assumptions is the matter of sexual drive. I'm not sure there is sexual drive. I know that the biologists and all kinds of other people are having loud and long discussions about it, serious. I think the weight seems to be that there is such a thing. I'm still not convinced. Sexual response, I indeed think there is. Sexual drive, I'm not sure about what that means. See, it was easy when there was a sexual drive and everybody bought in. Well, how many men got their way? Because, well, that's my sexual drive. I'm not sure. I'm not sure at all. I think that was neatly and socially implanted. And that would affect, that was an illustration of what I meant. But fourthly, in doing and going in this direction, there's a need in which we have to affirm the positive nature of our sexuality. Again, the inclination is because problems have occurred wherever along the line, mostly related to genital sex. Somebody having intercourse with somebody they weren't supposed to. Somebody having a baby when they weren't supposed to. Somebody, whatever, all those things. That the inclination is to come down hard on what's wrong. And you'll see in a moment, I am not trying to run from that. But I am terribly concerned that we are more adept, able, confident in saying what's wrong, but we haven't been quite clear in what's right. My contention would be you cannot be clear about what's wrong until you know what's right. It starts the other way around. That means both not only incarnational theology, which deals with God's presence with us in the flesh, but it deals with also a theology of the cross that understands what it means to live through and suffer and struggle and come out in death and resurrection terms about our sexual life. So in short, it seems to me if we go in this direction, we have to be willing to go beyond sexual ethics in setting up these guidelines and rules. When I say beyond, it doesn't mean away from, but beyond that to a sexual theology. And that's what these things are meant to try to take a crack at. If you want to pass these out, I'd appreciate it. Just pass them back in a couple places. And take some upstairs somewhere. Coming around? I'll make comments on this page for about 15 minutes or so and then invite your response and question. And hopefully we can have a discussion about that. I'd like to save time at the end just to refer to books again that I promised to do. All got copies? First paragraph is simply an effort to re-say what I said at the beginning. Seeing sexuality in the sense of the understanding of sex as an expression of the total human personality, a way of letting people know through your whole self who you are, what you like, how you feel and think. We express our sexuality through relationships, women with men, men with women, their parents, with their children, with friends, neighbors, co-workers, strangers, with members of the opposite sex and obviously members of the same sex. I made the mistake of referring that to that as a homosexual relationship, and I'd never do that again. It just means that we express our sexuality in that broadest sense with people of the same sex as well as the other. Wherever we express our personality to someone else, we are expressing our sexuality, whether we are aware of this or not. Now,
not advocating, that's the way you think about things all the time. You go bananas if you do that. But it is possible to think about it that way and to understand it that way. Okay? Here's some of the connections that I can see. As Christians, we see sexuality as a God-given and God-redeemed way of relating to people. That it isn't accidental and it isn't just genital that that has happened. That Christ redeemed our total being, our body, soul, mind, emotions, and desires, and that he rules over earthly matter and human processes, including our sexual relationships. It isn't only a way of saying that God in Christ redeemed the vagina and the penis, which would be another aspect of saying, a way of saying that genital part, but of the whole process of relating. That's also what Christ died, not simply for some hidden part of you, that we might call soul or spirit, but for the all of you, including the processes of your relationships. Second, as Christians, our understanding of sexuality begins with our view of our own selves. The value we place on ourselves as persons for whom Christ died and in whom God lives. Usually our acceptance of others depends on our acceptance of ourselves. So if the message that we get from Christianity is the value of ourselves as one for whom Christ died and in whom God lives, then it's possible for us to have a positive outlook towards ourselves as sexual beings, which is not always what we have, women or men, that we see ourselves as less than. And particularly in this genitalized society, orgiastic, it is that too perhaps, but orgasmistic society. That you know, the highlight of being a sexual person is to have an orgasm. Who said so? I'm not against orgasm. Take a lie detector test, absolutely. But that's the only or best or only that is most significant one to express ourselves as a sexual being. It's implied in so much of the advertising that is done. More so today, more explicitly, more effectively today than ever. Take sex out of our advertising. My guess is, 5 days before the economy collapses? How long would it be? It's all bent in that direction, implication in that direction. And the buying in isn't only because, isn't it lurid? Probably a lot of that. But isn't it what I would like to be? Because we're buying this ball of wax. Rather than understanding ourselves as, quote, healthy sexual beings without all the accoutrements that somebody else says that I'm going to have, whether it's large breasts, or lovely legs, or a handsome body, or whatever else, that may be that moves it towards that genital satisfaction. But rather, Christ has died for me and lives in me, I am able to express myself sexually to other beings in wholesome, healthy, satisfied, indeed pleasurable way. Thirdly, that as Christians we recognize the sexual dimension of all our relationships with others and work at seeing all persons in God's perspective. That others too are those for whom Christ died and in whom God lives. We learn that what happens to persons that comes. To love means to seek the best for others in our relationships with them. It isn't simply feeling good about them and being glad that you feel good in response to them, which is certainly part of our response to one another, but wanting that person the best for that person in our relationship with that person. So that it infects indeed the systems that we have. A couple of us were talking about administration and other things that the church does or that anybody does. What happens in that system that seeks the well-being of the others is the crucial matter. What happens in our sexual relationships when we consciously or unconsciously are relating to people of the opposite sex, the same sex, friends that we want to develop, or parental or child parent or whatever relationships we have,
What happens to that other person is what counts. And the gift of your sexual being, all that it means to you to be female or male, is the gift of helping that other person reach, seek fulfillment in that area. What we highlight in marriage as being focused, that we get together for the very reason of bringing each other to greater fulfillment as being personal, as persons and sexual beings, is true about the whole of life. And this is what that, to me, emphasizes. Four, as Christians, we affirm the spontaneity of our sexuality or of our sexual responses to one another. Our relationships are free rather than forced. They happen. To love means to be free to respond. God's love frees our sexuality or expressions of sexuality to bring about his kind of love in everyday, extraordinary, frustrating, or exciting situations of life. Again, the point is that sexuality isn't a manufactured way of doing things or a guidelines for not doing things. It is responding to the other person. And I know when we talk about this, a lot of people say, aha, this is a sneaky way at getting at permissive genital activity. And I say to you, no, it is not. And if one doesn't say this, one doesn't see the gospel involved in our bodies as well, in the presence of God. And we must say that the spontaneity is there, that we are free to respond in Jesus Christ to one another as sexual beings. Fifth, as Christians, that we take seriously God's particular concerns, directions, and limitations for expressing our sexuality.
especially as it relates to sexual intercourse, marriage, and reproduction of children. God has expressed himself in the scriptures. God has even made some sense, something sensible to ourselves that we can figure out, deducted from his revelation in the scriptures. And these, as Christians, we do take seriously. The difference that I was saying earlier is that we don't start with that. We start with the gift and work through how also the gift becomes a responsibility, if you will. Lots of money, if it's a gift of God, as I believe any kind of possession may be, can be used destructively, inappropriately with other people. Ability as a sexual person to express yourself can be used inappropriately, destructively. And I'm not talking again genital. Let me illustrate it by saying parents. Parents can control their children so that they cannot grow up to be the free and in Jesus Christ people that they were meant to be, but rather to possess them and to get one's identity through them. Now that's a sexual relationship that is being used to twist it around rather than enabling them to be, to hold them down and try to shape. Now, I know it's a fine line. I'm not trying to say every time we want our children to be like something, we're doing that. But it is a tough and it's a fine line. It isn't only in the way that we think about relating to other people generally. But it does have to do also with God's expression about where we understand the scriptures to reveal he has placed limitations about that. We'll talk about that if you want to in response after a while. Six. As Christians, we affirm the joy of God's forgiveness for our misuse of sexuality. And again, I'd start with our neglect, that we are aware of our neglect to express our sexuality as love, as fully as we are able. I suspect we may sin more there than on the other side. We also know that we often twist expressions of sexuality from lust into sin, part of our continuing human condition. Again, whether that be in friendship relationships, in married relationships, or in relationships to our children or to parents. But God has conquered lust, paid the price for sin and sins, and in his Son we are made alive again sexually. And seven. As Christians, we recognize God as the source of practical power to guide and control our expressions of sexuality. The promise of His Spirit as the, quote, one to stand with us, unquote, is constantly clear. What God makes, He services. Again, this is to set in the context or in the contrast to those who say, well, no, I can't do anything about it. That's the way I am. Well, that doesn't go in Christian circles. The way we are is what God has been working on all the time. And if it's at odds with his gift of love to us and through us to other people, then it's possible for us to be working on that with him. Not without struggle, not without grapple, not without all the other parts of it, but he promises to be with. Those things, the fear nots weren't so much of ghosts and big jumps off of cliffs, it seems to be. Fear not was, how do we be who we were meant to be? That you really can reach out, express yourself sexually to other people, as sexual beings, and still not destroy oneself or someone else. Oh, just a comment, the last comment, then I'll stop. The fact that we are so genitally oriented indicates that the way we express ourselves sexually has so much to do only with the body or parts of the body. And there are so many ways to express yourself sexually to another person. By listening, by taking seriously another person. A sexual experience of being listened to. To look into the eyes. Sometimes I agree with those that you suspect everybody who looks into your eyes because you think it's manufacturing or out to get you. To look into someone's eyes, to touch, to send a note. I have a whole thing about Christmas cards, you know, considered junk and all that, and we don't mimeograph long letters and all that stuff. But it's a terribly important, if you'll forgive me, sexual experience to reach out to all those people we know and to scribble 7 or 8 words on a page to them at Christmas time. Because we're sort of excited about what's happening at Christmas, and we want to have that touch with those people. Or to bring a flower. Or to write a poem. Or to grunt at the right time. Or whatever it may be. It's a whole range of them. And we have so limited those that getting a peek at a breast, or getting a touch of a part of the body that's hidden, or to get an erection, or to have an orgasm, is that's the only sexual expression. How impoverished we are that we can't understand how exciting it is to be sexual through words, and through being with, and remembering, or simply reaching out, or caring. Touch is part of that. I think that's why the move towards some form of touch in the liturgy has been very good, because it has affirmed that dimension of it, that you can shake hands if that's what you do, or put an arm around, or hug, or whatever else it may be. I know one parish that does it where it's almost, well, it's so close to the celebration of the Eucharist that it's almost the co-highlight of the service. Because their hugs and touches and caresses, it takes almost 20, 25 minutes in their parish. Because they're catching up on all the stuff that happened to those people during the week. And the sharing and the concern about a death or an illness or a job, or in this case even a divorce, goes on during that sharing. Those hugs mean a lot. I'm not a member of that parish, but man, am I glad to go there. Because in that moment, those moments, I experience a depth of concern. That is, I think, a very sexual thing. They wouldn't call it that. I do. Okay, I'll stop. Invite your responses, questions, additions.
Talked about our freedom in Christ, that we don't have to live under the gifts and or the fads of free sex, but that it is a special thing, a way of communicating not necessarily with words, but with concerns and love and care for one another.
What I hear you saying too is that expressing one's sexuality is to affirm another person in many different ways, but that affirmation can be the real basis for sexuality.
And a concern that might be in a correction as well, you know? If somebody's messing up their sexual being, it's a sexual response also to be that concerned about it. Again, because they are limiting their abilities. Sin is that, you know, is destructive to the possibilities. Here they are. You push at them enough, you see it quite clearly. And dealing with them, talking to other people. Somebody asked me, how do I get the people at Governor State University? Because I don't have any. Yeah, I can't use the categories, and most of them are so turned off by some religious experiences, I say, mostly unfairly. For all the people who were forced to go to church, who said they would go to church, we wouldn't have had enough churches to handle. Now, I was there back in those days when they said they were being forced. I think it's a bunch of junk. So they're really anti. But when I deal with people on their limits, where did they stop? When can't they go any further? Man, you can get in all kinds of possibilities. Because we don't like limits. There are limits to what we can all do, but when we have limited ourselves and we don't see some more possibilities, man, you can begin to open up all kinds of stuff. So that's what I was saying. Yes?
When we express our sexuality and our concern and caring for others or praying for others, we find many times that we benefit even more than the person that we're caring for. That if you pray for someone else, the benefit that comes back to you for your having prayed for them is many times seemingly a greater response within yourself than the person you have prayed for.
What if sexual intercourse is only a paradigm for that? If you are able to enable someone else to really enjoy this intercourse experience, most of the time, well, I'll tell my experience is, there's more for me. How great. Exciting. You know, if you're selfish about the intercourse experience, it can often not be what you want it to be for the other person or even for yourself. It seems to me it's a bit of a paradigm. We don't usually use that as a paradigm, but I think it may well be. And I think our rest of our experiences affirm the same. So it fits into a context. And then the kinds of meanings we give to those genital things are tested by these other experiences that you're talking about, rather than the other way around. Yes?
I'm not quite sure how to put it that it's clear, but I'm hearing you talk about sexuality and wholeness and everything, but I also heard something about concern when someone has not used sexuality in a whole way. I don't know. I'm having trouble saying that what I think is whole isn't the same as what my friends who have chosen not to express themselves in a heterosexual way say is whole. Can you say more about it? I guess that's what I mean. If I choose to relate only to a woman, is that less than whole? I don't know. I don't.
Yeah, all my illustrations. I would hope. I think a lot of my illustrations were heterosexual. But if you talk about broad sexuality, then it couldn't be only heterosexual. It would have to be with everyone. And how someone chooses to express themselves genitally to another person of the same sex, I think that's an important question to be asked. But again, I'd like to put it in the context of understanding the whole of sexuality. And that's, I think, what Jim Nelson is trying to do, too, in his book, to say, in that context, now it's a legitimate question to explore and go at, and where you come out with that. But that there will be differences of opinion there, or even in the other part of what wholeness is, yeah, I'm sure that that's right. And that's what I see the community of faith to be about. If there isn't a basis for it, like a lot of folks at Governor State and I don't agree on what that is. That's part of the discussion that goes on between us. And eventually, they back me up to say why, and I have to be saying why, and it has to be the faith that leads me to see wholeness perhaps differently than they do. Not always as much, but at first, very clearly different. But even within the faith, they're holding. We disagree about certain aspects of what wholeness may be. And that's what the community faith, I think, is led to do.
And so, can I follow? I want to make something from theoretical to practical. Can I follow from that to say that there's a wholeness in expressing the sexuality, so it is, I'm trying to take it into morality, so it is wrong for me to say that I can't deny someone a job because they are an avowed homosexual. That's wrong for me to say that, because that wholeness is perhaps there with them in a way that maybe it isn't even with me, because I am not an avowed homosexual and I could get that job. Mm-hmm.
I think I see that connection. I'm not sure about it, but I think I would say that in the society, but that does get us over into say, lay some groundwork of how we deal with what is called, trying to avoid the word deviation all the time, other than what is expected. I think it is related to our broad understanding of what it means to be sexually engaged. Yes, I do. How one makes that final jump and says yes or no about that in the system outside of us, like for jobs, or acceptance, more critically for us inside of the church, that we accept, if we would or would not accept, avowed homosexuals in our own community of faith, as leaders in that community of faith, or whatever it may be, there's even closer moral decisions that have to be made. But I would say it would come out of a solid understanding of what that means to be that sexual person, and then lead to it. And with some good discussion on what wholeness is about, in that context. Yes?
What's the difference between this use of the word my sexuality with just talking about my person?
Why
do we use the word? I say the same thing by saying my person is male.
As soon as you said it's male, it seems to me you
had it. That was my question,
yeah,
to Elmer. And I missed the first few minutes, so it may have been some remarks that you gave at that time. But I was wondering what would not be sexual and in relationships of all kinds. And then if everything is sexual, then what kind of specificity does the word have? Or what aspect of a whole range of relationships makes it have a sexual dimension to it? Is it eros? Is it, I think it's a question, Dan's is a statement, but
okay.
Synonym.
Yeah, it is tough. Fair through for myself as well. I'll tell you how I try it and see what you think and others. I think that it is an emphasis on an understanding of maleness and femaleness that isn't always present when we say person. So it is an effort to lift up an aspect of that that I think is important to do. Because I think we have so blanded personhood that maleness and femaleness are not clear. Or to say it negatively, we have so distorted personhood so that it is seen as a certain kind of maleness or roles in maleness in contrast to femaleness too. So I think that part of it would be one part. The second part that would take it away from just saying person, or maybe another way of saying it, is that it is a conscious effort to include also the biological and genital possibilities of it. So that in a relationship that would be called, to highlight a relationship that is sexual, would include the possibilities of the attraction that is involved. And how does one deal with that? And the responses to that. So in that sense, it would be, to me at least, be different than just talking about person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's helpful.
And I think I did say somewhere along the line that I'm not espousing this is a way to think and talk all the time, because I think that you can do that with a number of areas of life and you'd be distorted, but that it is helpful sometimes to think and talk this way because it lifts up those aspects that we would maybe popularly call roles on one hand and popularly call another call the genital possibilities of any relationship. You know, that's why we never get an incest. That's a genital possibility in a relationship. And indeed, I am told, an increasing one. In the reports being made about sexual abuse of children. Well, there's intervention. And I'm saying we ought to be ready to be talking about that in certain ways that are fit together so it makes sense with a whole theology about being a sexual person.
You implied that we are we have sexual attraction because of social learning. And I'm wondering, where does the physiology come? again, and the hormonal balance, which, you know, is shows, I mean, you can measure that by blood tests, for example. And I'm hearing you say that we learn it from watching something in our environment. And I'm wondering if you really intend to leave it there, or if you will imply that, yes, there is a definite hormone thing that happens that makes us be attracted to the opposite sex. Or to the same sex, even. Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't mean to leave it, if that's the way I said it before, there. I would say that it is both. I mean, I think there is a social acculturation, an acculturation process that does teach us many things, and there is chemical, hormonal kinds of things that happen as well. I'm not sure which that all is. I'm not even sure yet, and I haven't stayed abreast in the last 4 or 5 years as I had earlier, of some of the research in this area, where other people are in saying that. I have read, I thought, very responsible studies in both directions, in terms of, for instance, the hormonal business. I do think that is part of it. That's part of the created, the nature, the physical dimension of us. On the one hand, I think that has been, early on, before research, terribly distorted by, saying, by the drive business I was talking about. And on the other hand, I'm not sure what is being said. When I wrote way back in 1965, the publishers wanted a very strong statement. And the best literature I had at that time said, no way can I make a strong statement. I just don't know. And I don't think the literature knows yet about that point. But I believe that it is both, right? And I appreciate you bringing that up. Easy to leave it. A light you don't need to. Someone else? Yes.
I think part of the freedom comes, some of the best communicators I've ever met found some freedom in realizing some of the things that we've learned that bound us up, some of the Deuteronomy and Leviticus we live with each day. For instance, knowing that Norwegians really aren't comfortable talking to each other if they have eyes set at each other more than 7 seconds. They aren't comfortable at talking any closer than 2 feet from each other. A lot of those unconscious things that we do every day. I was just wondering if you could expound on that or comment on that.
Can't expound, I can just say yeah.
I find knowing that is a certain danger in it too. I find you throw that around in a small community and use that, it can be awfully detrimental in the communication. We'll be kind of get set apart. Yeah. You're different. You don't do the things that we do. That isn't kosher. It's an easy way to break down things, but I think it's a way to destroy things also, the awareness of that.
How we change, you know, new information, if that's what it might be, how we use that new information in relationship to other people, and the care and concern that we have about that, you know, the way we go about it would be terribly, terribly important. Any gift, especially any new gift, or our awareness of a new aspect of a gift, is a responsibility as well, to be sure. As I sit in the pew so often in churches, with all of the work that we did for LBW, I still think that there was some insensitivity to people as the books were brought into being. And I think the insensitivity came mostly in parishes. You know, I don't know about the whole church, but there was a lot of time spent in getting people ready. But I think a lot of people, I feel a lot of people are hurt by LBW. And it isn't because essentially because they didn't want change, but sometimes the way it was done. It was so gung-ho as of a given date, even though there was all kinds of things happening first. It was so gung-ho, now we are going. And I think sitting in this chair, Gordon Lather was saying 2 years ago, he said, crying out loud, don't get rid of all those old books. Hang on to them. Use the red, use the others. They're great. There's things in there that shouldn't be lost. So, well, I'm going off in the direction to say that sensitivity about bringing people with you and
in this business would be very important. I think that's caring, as somebody was saying this morning. Take care.
This is a different direction of work. Someone wants to go with that.
Anybody want else to say more? You want to say more about that? Okay.
I would just like to ask you, if you see portions of American society or groups in American society or no communities that we would all recognize where you really see what you would regard as healthy sexuality. I mean, it seems to me we've bounced from Puritan to Playboy, Playgirl. All of the manuals are examples of our obsession with technique. Advertising. I just look in vain for sort of public examples of healthy sexuality in the broad sense in which you use that word. Do you have some communities or examples or something in this society which you would point to and say that's a good role model, so to speak?
No, I do not, and that wouldn't mean that they aren't there. It just means, it may well mean that I don't know enough communities where that might be worked at. I do know some people, I know some couples, where the work at it is good, and then usually it's, you know, other people are being affected nearby, but I couldn't call it community. No, I still would go with the word I said earlier, that one of the needs is that in the midst of the chaos and confusion that we still have in this, and maybe it doesn't go that fast beyond it, people are longing for it. I truly believe that. When I so much divorce counseling that I do, and I know that's an extremist, but the longing for it, rather than turning against it. Why do 80 to 90% of them get married again? Sure, to take care of the kids maybe, but even when there aren't any kids, they're longing for something that's more. And even to share positively at that moment what you think it could be like is almost a breath of fresh air to them, because they didn't believe it could be possible, that anybody really thought that it was worth trying. No, I guess I'm... okay.